Psych Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about everything intro psych. I'm joined, as always, by my friend and my colleague, Paul Bloom. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, David. Good to talk to you again. We're going to talk today about social psychology. We're going to continue a discussion from our previous episode. And our topic is going to be a topic which is of interest to people both within and outside the field. It's how we think about human groups, including groups based on gender, on sex, on ethnicity, on race, on age, and how we stereotype the origins of prejudice, origins of racism. Could you give a sense of how big a topic that is for social psychologists?
Yeah, the area that we might call prejudice and stereotyping within social psychology is so central to the field that it... you know, it's obviously a very important topic to study, but if you look at the slice of the pie that prejudice and stereotyping takes up, you know, compared to the total number of topics in social psychology, it's pretty big, and it's probably bigger than a lot of things that we experience more on a daily basis. And it's traditionally been the case, I think, that social psychologists, many of them view themselves as, among other things, trying to directly understand social ills and in the hopes of being able to change society. This is true from the earliest of social psychologists who came from Europe and were interested in understanding what had happened in World War II, what had happened in Germany that had enabled people to turn on Jews and on other groups in such an ugly way. And social psychologists also just have for many years focused on racism, stereotyping, prejudice, all kinds of in-group and out-group aggression.
And one of the things which is surprising, I think, to people from outside the field is that when we talk about stereotyping, there's definitely an ugly side of it. But part of it just is the normal way we think about things. So one thing I raise in my intro psych class, and maybe the students are surprised by this, is that categorizing people and making inferences based on the categories isn't some weird pathology or act of cruelty or habit we need to get out of. It's fundamentally how our minds work. So cognitive psychologists, the people who study language and memory and rationality and development, will often also study how we categorize the world. And part of categorizing the world is developing an understanding of certain kinds of things. So if you know what a dog is, you probably know it typically has four legs and a tail and barks and eats meat and so on. You know what an apple is, you know that you can eat it. It typically has a certain color and so on. And when we come to social groups, it's not like all this shuts down. So you have not only just categories or stereotypes of dogs and apples, you have them of men and women. And so you might notice that men are on average taller than women. When I was raised, I would think, well, doctors tend to be men and nurses tend to be women. And we have all of these stereotypes in our heads. You say to somebody about a category like Canadian or Italian or somebody who's Jewish, and they have a bunch of beliefs and ideas about what members of that category should be like and call out a stereotype.
I do remember in graduate school wondering to myself why it was called concepts and categories in cognitive psychology. You know, stereotyping is just a subset of this. But of course, once you start talking about human groups and category members and how you categorize and how you make inferences about the members of that group, it takes on moral characteristics.
That's right. There are complicated moral problems with our stereotypes of people that don't arise with our stereotypes of, you know, animals or artifacts. I mean, even there's debates. We have stereotypes about kinds of dogs, and some dog owners, you know, bitterly resent the fact that there's some sort of profiling that, oh, if you have a pit bull, that must be a very dangerous dog. If you have another, that must be very smart. But the issues are very powerful with people because along with the capacity to stereotype groups, we have a strong moral belief that often, not always, but often, you should judge people based on their individual characteristics and not based on statistics of their group, even if the statistics are correct.
And I think it helps to illustrate why stereotyping and prejudice and in-group, out-group divides are so pernicious, the processes themselves are general processes. So when it comes to social groups, turning it off because you have a moral reason to do so is, I think, quite hard. And so the question then becomes, when is it appropriate to make generalizations and when is it inappropriate? And when it is inappropriate, if I deem that it is, how do I stop myself from doing that? Yeah. Or should I? Is it wrong?
Yeah. And societies make choices. I was talking to this old guy recently, and he was bitterly complaining about having to rent a car and being told, since he's over 80 years old, he has to pay extra. And he says, well, I'm a good driver. How could he do this to me? My sons, who are on the young side, have to pay extra also. So there's a sort of stereotyping based on age, which we're kind of comfortable with. We kind of live with. But, you know, on the other hand, I think it'd be quite a different thing if somebody said, oh, because of your ethnicity, we're going to charge you more. Even if the insurance company said, look at our data, people of this ethnicity get into more crashes, so we're going to charge you more. You might just say, well, you can't do that.
Right. The social psychologist Phil Tetlock illustrates this nicely when he talks about these taboos. You're allowed, for instance, to say, by allowed here, I mean it's deemed socially not inappropriate to say that teenage boys should be charged higher insurance because the statistics show that they get into more accidents. But you wouldn't be allowed to if the data were that, since I'm South American, I'll just say, use my own ethnicity, that Latin Americans get into more accidents. Even if the numbers said that, yeah, it would be considered immoral.
We'll just talk about Latin Americans and Jews, in this section, so that it's entirely self-reflexive, you know. And so, right, there's an episode of the comedy show Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry is, the main character, Larry's getting divorced, and he discovers to his shock that his lawyer is not Jewish, as he thought he was. And he gets another lawyer. He wants a Jewish lawyer because Jewish lawyers are much better, he believes. Whether that's right or wrong, that's a stereotype, which would be taboo in some places. But one thing is, we use them all the time. So if you're looking for directions, you're not going to ask a four-year-old because, you know, they're typically not good at directions. If you're in New York City and you bump into, say, a young black gay woman, you may assume she has more liberal politics than most. You could be wrong. She could be a very right-wing person. But odds are, given the math, you're safe to assume her politics. And it's quite different if you were to deal with, you know, an older man, for instance. These things track, they track age, they track race, they track gender. And it's an interesting question. What generalizations are correct and when is it morally appropriate to draw upon them?
Categorizing by race does feel a little bit different than, say, categorizing cognitive ability by age. Race, as a category of thing, just is a little weird and squishy and not what we think it is often.
So that's one of the interesting findings in psychology. It goes under the broad term of essentialism. And many psychologists, Susan Gelman has done some wonderful developmental work on this, believe that we essentialize categories, and particularly social categories. And this can have different meanings, but the main claim here is that we tend to think that these categories have something intrinsic about them that make them what they are. And often it comes with a belief that membership in the category is all or nothing. And this simply isn't true. For some Jews and some non-Jews, to be Jewish is to have a single parent of Jewish ethnicity. And for others, it has to be the mother. And it's not like you ask a biologist who's right. These are social religious choices. In the United States, there's essentially a one-drop rule for who's black, where if you have, you know, black ancestry, they count you as black, even if the majority of your genetic ancestry is non-black. And again, this isn't like a fact of science. These are social choices. It's social choices to view somebody like Barack Obama, who one parent is black, one parent is white, to figure out how to categorize them and say, oh, you got to be one or the other.
And in some countries and cultures, that decision might go another way. These categories aren't reflecting anything that can be seen under a microscope. I think that a lot of people confuse this because race and ethnicity is obviously based on some sort of genetic relationship, some sort of genetic family history, but it's so complex the way that we use that basic information and turn them into categories where we lump an Ethiopian and a Kenyan in the same race, even though genetically they might be further apart than, say, a Latin American and an Asian person.
That's right. And you see tremendous social forces at work for these decisions. You know, there's arguments right now, are Jews white? And whatever that argument is, it's not an argument that's going to be resolved by carefully studying DNA and doing careful science on it. These are social questions. And race is, like you said, an odd combination of, to some extent, genetics. People describe so-called races as extended families, and there's some truth to that, but also social conditions as to cutoffs and boundaries. And you see a sort of mismatch between a proper conceptual understanding of these issues and how people naturally view it, where people naturally often draw sharp divisions where none exist.
So can we say that all of the cognitive machinery that is used to categorize everything in the physical world, and even in the world of cultural artifacts, get recruited to make distinctions on fairly arbitrary social categories?
Yeah, there's actually a huge literature in social psychology making that point very well. So Henri Tajfel, who was one of the refugees from Europe at the end of World War II, I think, did some lovely studies where he wanted to study intergroup animosity and why we hate one group over another. But he didn't want to use real groups. He wanted to push the point that these groups can be as arbitrary as you want. So he did this wonderful study where he got people and he gave them a sort of sham test. And in the spirit of social psychologists everywhere, he lied to them and told half of them that they are Kandinsky lovers and half of them that they are Klee lovers.
Two artists. By the way,
yes. Two artists. We assume everybody is intimately familiar with the work of Kandinsky and Klee. As we frantically Google.
These were very different times.
These were different times. That's right. Now it'd be lovers of, Breaking Bad versus Better Call Saul right. Or something. But the finding is based on this arbitrary distinction. People would align themselves with the group they were put into. The Klee lovers would favor other Klee lovers when they had to make a choice. They might think Klee lovers are better. Other work simply flips a coin, head or tails. I flip head, you flip tails, and we favor our own group. There's work with children, and I'd love to talk about some of the kid work, because the kid work is fascinating, but where they put kids in red t-shirts or blue t-shirts, and with the slightest prod, they start organizing themselves into different groups. And I think this shows us something important, which is that we are very groupy. We are very inclined to break the world up into us versus them. And the patterns that we see when we chop up the world into Jew, non-Jew, black, white, and all this, to some extent reflect just our natural propensity to find groups everywhere. You know, in some cases, the groups may have some sort of genetic backing. In other cases, like, Capricorn versus Sagittarius, they have none at all. They're just arbitrary. But we're quite happy to chop up the world that way.
So let's talk about the developmental work, because one of the questions that you can ask, you can say, well, we know from observation and we know from decades of social psychology work that race is central, at least in some cultures, but in the United States for sure, race is a central category that we use to make inferences about other people. And some of it just depends on visual cues, how I categorize somebody as belonging to one race or another based on how they look, whether that's correct or incorrect. But it's so central that way of categorizing people into races and ethnicity seems so central that it might seem like it's a natural way Like some people might even think, well, we've evolved to look at skin color or facial features as a way to distinguish out-group versus in-group members, which I think has some problems. But one way to answer the question is to look at kids. And so do very young children categorize people based on this appearance?
It's a great question. I did some work on babies' appreciation of in-groups and out-groups with my colleagues at Yale. And this ended up getting some popular press attention. And I see it, you know, online as babies born bigots or babies are little racists. And I don't think that that's right. I think it's more complicated. So from the get-go, babies are subject to in-group, out-group biases. That is, if you put them into different categories, you know, what t-shirt they're wearing or something like that, they will favor their own category. Very early on, they break up the world by age. They distinguish children from adults. Very early on, they break up the world by gender, distinguishing boys from girls, men from women. Very early on, and this is a real discovery from Katie Kinsler and her colleagues, they're very focused on language. So there's some nice experiments where you have this, an American kid, say a baby or a two-year-old or a three-year-old, a black woman is offering the baby some food. A white woman is also offering the baby some food. And one of them is speaking with an accent. Babies ignore color altogether, and they avoid the one speaking with an accent. English-speaking babies prefer English speakers with no accent. French-speaking babies, who are exposed to French, prefer French speakers without an accent. Now, race is really complicated. So there's two things to keep in mind. One thing is babies do show a preference for looking at faces that are the same race as the faces they have been exposed to. There's a familiarity bias. So it's not the kid's own skin color. The kid probably doesn't even know his or her own skin color. But a kid raised by light-skinned people will prefer to look at light-skinned people. Raised by dark-skinned people prefer to look at dark-skinned people. A study done with Ethiopian immigrants to Israel, where the kids were raised by multicolored people, found no preference. Kids prefer to look at everybody. So people saw this initial data and said, oh, they're kind of biased. But it turns out that when it comes to their choices, who to interact with, who to take a toy from, who to want to talk to, bias based on what we call race doesn't show up until quite later. It's like kids notice the difference and it affects who they like to look at, but they don't take it seriously. It's only later when the society says, you know the color of your skin, that's important. That's how we divvy up resources. That's who we decide who plays with whom. Then kids develop biases. So kids raised, for instance, in schools where there just isn't much racial distinction, race isn't made a big deal of, tend not to develop any racist biases. Kids raised in schools where race is a big thing do develop racist biases. It's like you start off with a natural tendency to break the world up into us versus them. And then society tells you, who's the us and who's the them?
I alluded to something earlier when I was talking about whether or not there were evolutionary accounts that might predict that infants would care about race. And I said they're problematic because race is not something that our ancestors had a notion of in the sense that we do, because they didn't come into, Black people and Asian people didn't meet.
Yeah.
This doesn't seem like it would be a category that's built in any way. You would need our ancestors to have actually encountered people who looked drastically different from them. And that just didn't happen. But what probably did happen was the local tribe spoke a different language. And that might be a very efficient way of knowing the difference between us and them.
That's right. And it's a nice example of how evolutionary considerations can shape how we do our psychology. So it's long been known that when you look at somebody, there's three things you take away from it, three main categories. And their age, gender or sex, however you want to view it, and race. And we find this, for instance, in memory confusion studies. So if you hear a sentence said by an old white woman, you're more likely to misremember it when you get it wrong and then attribute it to another old white woman. as opposed to a younger Black man, for instance. And in fact, when people make sometimes often embarrassing mistakes in public, where they mix up one person with another, they typically, what makes it embarrassing is they typically get the race right and the age right and the gender right, and then just the person wrong. But the evolutionary psychologists say, okay, age makes sense. From a standpoint of dealing with a person, it really matters whether you're dealing with a 5-year-old, a 30-year-old, or a 60-year-old. It determines, you know, how much, are you going to get in a fight with them? Do you have to care for them? Are they going to be healthy? Sex/gender matters a lot. Depends who you're going to mate with, how it relates to family structures. But race, for exactly the reason you're saying, is a puzzle. Why in the world we take race so seriously when it's not something we've been attuned to in our evolutionary past? And the solution is what we alluded to before, which is that we don't take race seriously in and of itself. We take race seriously insofar as it's a surrogate for social categories that matter. So if somebody was to say, in this sense, race is a social construction, I think there's a lot of truth to it, which is societies, for different reasons, make genetic ancestry and historical categories count a lot. And you're raised in that society and you say, wow, where I'm living, the in-group is this race and the out-group is that race.
Yeah. And you point to a study that was done a number of years ago on race really as a proxy for coalitions. Along the lines of what you're saying, where they used people of different races, but wearing shirts representing different teams.
That's right. So the analogy here is you're watching a basketball game, and some players on one team are white, some are Black, some players on the other team are white, others are Black. But there you're watching, you're seeing a real powerful case of two groups in competition. In that case, when you think of it that way, race disappears. You no longer think of them in terms of race. And so there, in a memory confusion problem, you're then more likely to confuse, say, a Black player from Team A with a white player from Team A than with a Black player from Team B. All of a sudden, you don't care about race, because you're now in a situation where race doesn't matter. And, you know, and a lot of the sort of practical side of social psychology says, you know, one way to fix strong racial biases is to bring people into situations where race just matters less. It's sometimes called the contact hypothesis, where if you meet people from different races and different ethnicities in a situation which is egalitarian and you're all fighting for a common cause and everything, like sports, like the military, race will just matter less.
What that illustrates is that this kind of categorizing and being prejudiced on the basis of race can be erased, as the authors call it. But it also shows how important race as a category in our culture is. We're constantly in a condition where it's not sports, it's race and ethnicity.
That's right. And there's long been a political debate over how do you deal with it, where one moral stance says we should aspire towards a sort of colorblindness, where race doesn't matter at all. And that's a goal, both personal goal and a societal goal. Other people have a different perspective, and they say, no, we should actually just focus more on our racial identities, make sure the different groups treat one another with respect. But we shouldn't in some way try to erase race. And in fact, maybe you might, for instance, argue that trying to erase race in the here and now will just serve to perpetrate pre-existing inequalities without addressing them. But these are questions that are I wouldn't say above our pay grade, but they're political ones. They're not psychological ones.
Yeah, that's right. The very question of what to do, given that members of certain races have been treated poorly for hundreds of years, it seems like a very facile solution to say, "Oh, let's stop talking about it. let's just forget about race for now."
And there's the fact that as psychologists, we tend to talk about race and ethnicity. We use it interchangeably in terms of the evils of racism and discrimination and cruelty. But in the real world, people identify themselves with the different groups. They take pride in them. They take them seriously. I think many people, if you just told them, you know, we have a plan in place to obliterate your group, not by killing you all, but simply so that in the future, there'll be no more people who call themselves Jews. There'll be no more people who call themselves Italians, would say, well, I like my group. I think my group adds some stuff. I identify myself with them. And that's a consideration to be taken into account as well.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you once again by GiveWell. If you're considering donating to charity, or if you've never donated to charity before and you're interested in figuring out where your money would go, well, that can be difficult, if not downright impossible. Charities aren't exactly open and forthcoming with that information sometimes on their websites. So it can be hard to track down exactly what your money is doing and how much impact it will have. That's what GiveWell is all about. They've dedicated a ton of staff, over 40,000 hours each year, to trying to find the highest impact, evidence-backed opportunities for people to donate their hard-earned money. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell's research and their service to donate more than $1 billion. And rigorous evidence suggests that these donations will save over 150,000 lives and improve the lives of millions more. So if you are just interested in the research, you can go to givewell.org and they've published all of their research absolutely free. You don't even need to sign up. No personal information needs to be given. And you can use all of their research to figure out where to donate to, where your money will go, and essentially how much impact each dollar that you give will have. But also, if you want to use GiveWell and donate through them, they'll allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity or fund of your choice, and they won't take a cut at all. They're not about taking any money. They really just want to make the process of donating to charity more effective. So if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $500 before the end of the year or as long as matching funds last. To claim your match, all you have to do is go to givewell.org and pick podcast and enter psych at checkout, just to make sure that they know you heard about them through us. That's givewell.org, pick podcast, and enter psych at checkout. Our thanks to GiveWell for sponsoring this episode of Psych.
So a lot of what we're talking about here, and this is how sort of people tend to talk about race, and it's sort of explicit biases. You know, you ask me, say, who do you want to date? What do you think of the blue t-shirt people? What do you think of the red t-shirt people? You know, tell me honestly your stereotypes about the Jews. But psychologists, social psychologists, and this is one of the big revolutions in the field, have long been interested in implicit biases. Biases that, well, I'll let you define it because the definition's controversial. What is an implicit bias?
Let me start with a little bit of history of social psychology. It used to be the case when social psychology started that if you wanted to know whether or not somebody was prejudiced, if you want to know whether a white American had negative attitudes toward Black Americans, you just asked them and they would tell you. Right? If you said, would you let a Black person date your daughter? They would just say no, if they were prejudiced. Obviously, after a while, that stopped being the case. Now, as many social psychologists and most people suspected, this wasn't because prejudice went away entirely. It was simply because people knew that it was a bad thing to express such preferences. Now, the question became, has it gotten to a point where it's just that people are lying about these racial prejudices? Maybe it's the case that even when people are being honest and saying, I have no such preferences, there is a deeper part of them that still harbors those prejudices. These are not things that are even explicitly available to their own awareness. So if you ask the average person, are you racist? They would say no, and they wouldn't be lying. But you look at society and you say, clearly there still is a large amount of inequality based on race and ethnicity. So maybe what's going on is that people don't themselves know that they are biased in this way. Nonetheless, in the depths of their mind, they're still harboring these prejudices, and this might come out, say, in their behavior. Or, as social psychologists discovered they could do, in some tasks that are meant to assess your attitudes in a way that you have no real control over.
So just to jump in, there are sort of three categories, three ways to be racist, though whether the word racist should apply for all of them is unclear. One way is that I don't want my daughter to date Italians, and I will tell you that. The second one is that I don't want my daughter to date Italians, and I'll keep it secret, but I know I have this belief. The third, the most interesting sort is I have this animosity against Italians, but I don't know it myself. At some level, I feel I'm not prejudiced at all, and I'm honest about it. I'm not hiding anything. But in subtle ways, my bias shows through. And we call that implicit bias.
That's right. And I think that there is a lay sense that this happens. Let's go back to Freud. Freud was interested in what he called parapraxis, slips of the tongue. You might imagine that somebody says, "No, I got no problem with Italians. It's fine." But every once in a while, a little comment emerges that illustrates that maybe their view of Italians is negative. They're more quickly to think of Italians when they think of a particular trait that's nasty. An off-color joke about Italians escapes them, even though they insist that they're not at all biased against Italians. They just think it's a funny joke.
It is very Freudian. It is very Freudian. In fact, some of the examples could come from Freud. For instance, one way a bias will show itself would be, suppose I want to describe a typical social psychologist, and I say, "Well, he," and I describe a man. And what if most people do that? That would suggest. But if you ask me, do I think a social psychologist has to be a man? And of course not. Maybe if you ask me and even say, "Oh, there's just as many women in the field as men. Certainly for developmental psychologists, there's more women than men." But maybe what comes to mind is a man, and that's the sort of implicit system working. You know, the extreme example is, you know, I'm thinking about a criminal, and I say, "Oh, I could," and automatically a certain race comes to mind. I'm thinking of a brave hero, and a certain race comes to mind.
And so social psychologists who are interested in the possibility that prejudice exists, that's lurking, you know, deeper in the mind than we might think, develop some tools based on some work in cognitive psychology, develop tools to try to assess whether or not this was the case. And one of them that you highlight was developed by our friend and former colleague Mazarin Banaji and Tony Greenwald, and it's called the Implicit Associations Test. Do you want to describe that? I don't know if we should.
So here's one sort of example. Suppose you take a test looking at whether or not you're biased towards the elderly or against the elderly, and you ask them, "Oh, I have no bias at all. I don't care about age." But then you play a little game where they're on a computer screen and you say you're going to see faces of old people and young people. And if you see, and you're also going to see words, and the words are going to be positive, like good or wonderful, or negative, like poison. And here's what you have to do. In one condition, people are told, when you see an old face or a positive word, hit this button. And if you see a young face and a negative word, hit that button. So they get a series of faces and words, and they're pounding away the button, and how fast they do it is measured. In the other condition, they're told, if you see an old face and a negative word, hit this button, versus if you see a young face and a positive word, hit that button. And in this subtle way, you kind of tap whether or not there's an association between old and positive or young and positive. And in fact, what this study will find is people are a little bit slower matching old and positive and young and negative than they are matching old and negative and young and positive, presumably because positivity is linked more up to the young and negativity is linked more up to the old. Is that a fair description?
That was great. And you can very nicely give people these tests and ask them before or after explicitly, do you hold any bias against old people? And you can compare their explicit and their implicit attitudes. And what you find with many of these categories about race, about age, is that there is a dissociation. People say, no, I don't have any bias. Nonetheless, this implicit task demonstrates a bias. So the real question is, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Is this showing that in fact people are being prejudiced or they do in fact hold prejudiced attitudes? What does it even mean if they don't know that they do?
Yeah. And here you and I may have different takes. I'm somewhat skeptical about what these studies show. I'll first say what I'm not skeptical about, which is I think in the aggregate, a lot of these studies can show some very interesting things, often about relative bias. So I talk about a study by Mazrin Banaji with Tessa Charlesworth. And what they did was they took online data from 4.5 million subjects from 2007 to 2016, and they looked at their attitudes about sexual orientation, race, skin tone, age, disability, and body weight. And they also asked about explicit attitudes, like, you know, I strongly prefer young people to old people. What do you think of that? And what they found was over about 10-year period, people became less biased explicitly for just about everything. And, you know, that's maybe not a huge surprise. You know, you could say regarding gay people, there's been profound differences in attitudes towards gay people over those times. But the implicit attitudes also found a decline in some ways. There's a decline in implicit negative attitudes for race, skin tone, sexual orientation, less of a decline for age and disability. And our attitudes got worse in the domain of body weight, suggesting that at least implicitly, we become harder on people who deviate from the ideal weight. And so it's really interesting to use these measures to say, you know, well, you know, we see this sort of attitude gets worse, this sort of attitude gets better. That's what I like about these studies. I mean, there's other studies using sort of simpler methods that compare how seriously, if you're evaluating somebody's resume and there's a black face on it versus a white face, how biased are you? What if it's somebody who describes themselves as conservative or liberal? How biased are you? I think that stuff's really cool. Here's my criticism, or here's my problem, a set of problems. These are often used as an individual measure of how racist you are. I take the test. You could take the test too. You go online. You just Google Harvard IAT, and it'll pop up. And this test will show me in which ways I have implicit biases towards one group or another. And then sometimes people walk away saying, oh my God, I'm racist. I'm sexist. I don't like gay people. I have all these biases. And I think this is the wrong moral to take from it for a couple of reasons. And to be fair, the people who do these tests are now very cautious against using them as individual measures of how racist you are. So one point is there's a lot of variability in the responses. If I don't like how I perform on a test now, I could take it again tomorrow and my results will change quite a bit. A second thing is that there's not much of a correlation between how well you score on these tests and how you behave in the real world. There's some controversy over this, but when big studies are done, it turns out that doing very badly on a race IAT doesn't seem to predict that you're particularly nasty towards people of a different race. And then the third concern, which is more theoretical, is it's not clear this measures animus, like really dislike or hatred, which you might think is part and parcel of really being racist, as opposed to just associations. So, you know, if I find it quicker to relate elderly people with bad words and than I do to relate them to good words, that might not mean that I myself have anything against elderly people. It might just mean that I understand in the world we live in, that there are biases against elderly people. And so too for people who weigh more than average and so on. For all these reasons, I'm cautious about going too far in what the IAT shows us.
I am cautious as well. And I do disagree, and I'll lay out a bit about why I disagree. But I think what we do agree on is that certainly the case hasn't yet been made in any convincing way that these measures as individual differences ought to be treated as showing whether or not you're truly racist. And I think one of the errors that the researchers made early on was in giving individual feedback. So I remember taking the IAT for the first time and getting the score telling me that I am kind of medium anti-Black. That can throw people for a loop. In fact, the feedback that many African Americans received was that they were anti-Black. And this was upsetting for many. I don't think we ought to use these tests for the problems that you outlined as an assessment of deep or true attitudes, especially not if you go the route of believing that what's going on is that you're just lying about your explicit attitudes. And now we've discovered that you, in fact, are racist. And one of the things that people have tried, flirted with, let's say, is using these kinds of tests to make hiring decisions.
Yeah.
Which I think is sorely misguided. If the only criticism were the first one that you mentioned, that what we call test-retest reliability is low, is the chances that your score tomorrow will be the same as your score today is bad. It would be like having a scale that gave you a different weight from day to day without anything having changed in your actual weight. We would just call that a terrible measure. We would say that's a bad scale. Let's toss it out. We need to get a better scale.
And just to jump in just one subtle point, which is you might think that we're sort of contradicting one another, where I say these tests in the aggregate could tell us something about changes through time. And now we're saying, but they're so unreliable. But these two could both be right. So your scale analogy is very good. Suppose your scale could be off by 5 pounds either ways. So that's a horrible way of measuring how much I weigh. But if you use that lousy scale and you found that from the years, from the last decade, people's weight went gradually up, that could still be a real finding. Even an unreliable measure, if it's unreliable within certain parameters, can tell you about broader patterns.
That's right.
I just wanted to interrupt for that.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And think of it as taking a driving exam when you have to pass the test for your driver's license. One day you might be nervous, you might not have slept well, your performance will go down for whatever reason. The instructor wasn't very kind to you, made you nervous. Next time you take it, your driving ability hasn't changed, but you got better sleep, you had less caffeine, the driving instructor was kind and polite, and you perform better. It could be that this has nothing to do with your true driving ability, but rather just some feature of the environment that was causing your score to change. If you took enough driving tests, if you went for 14 days in a row, and we computed the average score, we would have something meaningful, because over all of those trials, you would start being able to statistically see a pattern, whereas just taking it once is bad. So just taking the implicit association test once, I think, is not going to tell you that much, even though we've just told you to go to the implicit website. You have to know that this is the case. You might take it again tomorrow and it would be different. But in what we just said, in whether you aggregate thousands of people over decades, you could aggregate one person over multiple trials, just like the driving test example. And if this test is measuring anything of importance, what you might get is a more reliable estimate of what your quote unquote true implicit attitudes are. So we could get rid of the error that one day something happened that made you score differently than another day. So let's say that that's the case. Let's take care of that statistical issue. The second thing that you brought up was that research has not done a good job of showing that your score on this thing is good at predicting real world prejudice behavior. And you mentioned one reason might be that it's just a bad measure, right? Which might account for all of these findings, that it's if it's unreliable, if you only took it once, it has no real shot of predicting what your real world prejudice behavior would be. But suppose we had a better measure. We gave it to you a bunch of times and we have a better estimate. Would that predict your real world prejudice behavior? And I think here you have to look at the way in which we try to assess real world prejudice behavior. Maybe a true bigot, like a real just nasty white supremacist person who goes around saying bad things about Black people and who is doing things like refusing to hire them based on their race or telling their children to never date them. That would give you a lot of real world behaviors.
Yeah.
And that would give you, again, a reliable estimate of whether or not this person was in fact behaving like this in the real world. But it's difficult in the range of people that we're talking about, your average person, how can you tell from their behaviors whether or not they're prejudiced? Suppose that one time in the entire year, they refuse to hire someone on the basis of their race. I would say, well, that's a bigoted thing to do. And I would even call that person racist. The ways in which we try to assess real world behavior are bad. They only give us the smallest shot of a thin slice of an individual's life, given the situation we put them in and given the measures that we're using. We don't have a very good chance of documenting a real world prejudice behavior. And I think for that reason, we need to think not that these studies are showing that there is no relationship, rather they're just failing to show anything because you got bad measures on both sides. So if you followed someone and documented all of their behaviors over a month, and you had lots and lots of observations of their behavior, then maybe I think you could come up with a reliable estimate of whether or not their behavior showed prejudice in any way. And then if you match that with a very good estimate of their implicit attitudes, there you finally might get a shot of answering the question, do your implicit attitudes predict your prejudice behavior? And we haven't done that.
No, that's fair enough. But let me ask. So you do this. You test an individual 100 times.
Yeah.
Get a good sense of them. And then you monitor. Maybe there's a camera on them for a full year and a team of people judges how well they treat people of different races. And you say, and suppose you're right. You do get a relationship between their implicit attitude and how racist they are in the real world.
And just to be clear, I'm not saying that you would. I'm saying that we have zero evidence, really, I think.
Right. So it's the absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. I'm saying that we haven't found much predictive power. You say it hasn't been put to the test properly. But do you think it would do better than asking this, you know, I'm now imagining my own stereotypes are, and I'm imagining a Southern, sweaty sheriff, you know, chomping a cigar, white guy, you know.
Like the Dukes of Hazzard.
I'm imagining the sheriff and the Dukes of Hazzard as your prototypical racist. And there my stereotypes are at work. Do you think you would do better off with this implicit measure as opposed to asking him in an anonymous poll, tell me, what do you think of Black people?
No, I think in those cases, the implicit measure wouldn't be adding much. I think the only interesting cases are where you have the dissociation, and what you're presumably trying to uncover is that there is something that people either deny or don't even know. Because I think in those cases, you know, if you show me pictures of snakes and spiders versus flowers, the implicit association test does a very good job showing that I associate negatives with snakes and spiders and positives with flowers. And so you could have just asked me. You're getting no additional. In fact, for racism, if they're willing to say it out loud, then that is probably a more reliable metric.
So you're more in weeds on this than me. Let me raise some. You tell me if this is a legitimate worry. I could see two types of people doing very poorly. That is showing a strong racist response on a race IAT. One is this racist guy who, whenever he thinks of a black person, thinks, oh, that's awful. I think of a white person, that's the best. But the other sort of person I could see doing poorly is maybe somebody who's himself is a black person who's extremely steeped in knowledge and appreciation of discrimination against black people. So they see black linked up with a black face linked up with horrible on the IAT and said, oh God, that goes together so well because there's so many people think they're horrible. And so they're responding not based on their own animus, but rather on their appreciation of prejudice exists in the environment. Somebody who is, for instance, to change the example a bit, who is very upset about discrimination against people who are overweight, may be really quick to associate overweight people with negative words because that's exactly what they're upset about. So they see the connection.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I hadn't addressed your third concern that maybe, which is what this example is showing, that maybe there are people who simply have these associations in their minds because they exist in the world so much. And so the person who is really in-depth studying the problem of anti-fat prejudice will have read so many things that maybe fat and bad were concepts that are linked up so strongly. That's it's a good question. And it's an empirical question that I don't know if we've answered sufficiently. But let me push back a little bit on this because it kind of gets to what I think is the heart of this debate, which is what do we mean by having a belief or having an attitude?
Yes.
So in many domains, you would say, what does it mean to learn something? We talked about this a bit with behaviorism. You learn something by associative processes. This thing and this thing go together. In our episode on behaviorism, I told you the story about how via classical conditioning, I came to associate the HBO logo, the little screen that comes up with the static and the sound of static and the HBO visual, because it was attached to The Sopranos. It came right before The Sopranos, and I came to love The Sopranos. I developed this connection between the static HBO logo and good, solely through it being consistently paired with a good thing. In that case, we would just say that I have a good attitude toward the static. Sure, I never endorsed it. I never even really thought about it. But just the fact that over and over again, it's been associated with something that I deem to be good makes me think that what I have is a pro attitude toward that logo. Why is it the case that if you've shown me a black man and violence, a black man and violence, a black man and violence over and over again, and now I have this association that is, when I see a black male face, I think negative and violence, how is that not an attitude? I think that this critique of implicit association tests as tracking associations and therefore not really being belief is mistaking the external world for the internal one. It's only interesting that the associations are out in the world because they've made their way into my mind. Once they've made their way into my mind, how can I distinguish my black male and violence connection from my HBO logo and good vibes?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'll say two things in response. Okay. One thing is the HBO logo example cuts both ways because not only do you associate it with a feeling of happiness, but you know you do.
Yeah.
So there, you got the implicit, but at the same time, the explicit comes for the ride.
That's right. But Paul, I think that there might have been a moment when I didn't know.
Maybe.
And there was a moment of realization when that logo came up in a completely unrelated show that I was feeling excited. And then I reasoned my way to, oh, that's right. I have this association with this logo.
No, that's fair enough. And it's also fair enough that sometimes you put together these things in your head. And it seems weird to say it's just an association. Well, if it carries negative feelings with it or positive feelings, then, you know, we could argue about whether the word attitude, but it has emotional weight to it.
Right.
It's not this abstract thing. All I'll say is there is research suggesting that emotional weight isn't necessary to get it in your head. So these experiments where they don't give you the actual experience, they just tell you. They say, let me tell you about two made-up groups, you know, in a faraway land. You know, the Flobbles are despised for their bad behavior, and the Wubbles are beloved, and everybody loves the Wubbles. And then you give them an IAT with Flobbles and Wubbles, and boom, it gets treated like a despised group and a loved group in the real world, even though you just heard this. It's just stuff you stored in your head.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're converging on the idea that there could be a heterogeneity of many different types of implicit cognitions, some emotionally laden, some not.
I would fully endorse that. You know, what I would say about those cases is there is something negative there.
Yeah.
But it's probably just not that powerful. But once you get, I guess what I believe is once you get the evaluative system kicking in, once you have paired something categorize it as negative, that there is some weight there. Now, whether that's psychologically relevant, and in the sense that this would make a difference to my expressed attitudes or my behaviors, might be way, way too weak. I mean, I don't think that there's any realistic way in which you could say that I'm racist against Flobbles or whatever the group was. But I will say this, and I'm going to be very candid here because I think it's important to express my own experience with this stuff. Having been raised as my family were immigrants, came to the United States as Latin Americans. I identify as Hispanic, but I have been raised in this country with all of the racist ills that we know that it has. I lived in Miami, then California. Two different times I saw race riots happen in cities very close to me. I'm not immune from the negative associations of especially Black men and bad. And when I took the IAT for the first time, which wasn't on the website, it was in Mazarin Banaji's lab as they had recently developed it. And I got the result that I had some negative associations with Black faces. I wasn't surprised at all.
Yeah.
I'm a little racist, and I have zero problem admitting that. And it's not just against Black people. I'm a little racist about a lot of groups. It's something that I know because I get those little pangs of negative thoughts, negative feelings in certain situations, not in all of them. And I think that it's deeply important for my own development as a moral human being that I understand that those things happen, because the only chance I'll have of correcting them, or at least trying to correct them, is by first realizing that I have them. And in that sense, I think the IAT, as crappy as it is a psychometric test, might be giving us something valuable, which is you could imagine that somebody might live their life in denial by saying, there is nothing in me. There's not a prejudiced bone in my body.
Yeah.
When in reality, they're having mild negative attitudes towards a whole lot of individuals and groups that might leak out and might be noticed by members of those groups, but not at all even by the person who's leaking them out.
So in that way, you're saying one of the powers of the IAT is it could make what would otherwise be unconscious and bring it up to your consciousness, bring it up to conscious awareness.
Like Freud said, the goal of therapy, to make the unconscious conscious.
it gives you insight. And mm-hmm. And it's not really magic. I see your point, which is that, you know, every time the HBO logo comes on it, so you give a little smile. And I say to you, you know, boy, you've really associated that with Sopranos. That makes you right. And say, you know, you're right. I now when I reflect on it, I see that. And the dark side is, I say, you know, we've tested you and you seem to associate this group with negativity. And you say, you know, yeah, I see that. And then the project, which is the project, I end a chapter on this project, is what do you do about it?
Yeah.
I mean, suppose when I'm facing a member of a certain group and I'm interviewing them, I am biased against them. I'm biased against them because they're Black. I'm biased against them because they're a man. And most of my people I interview for developmental psychology graduate are women. I'm biased against them because they don't share my political views, maybe because they're trans or gay, maybe because they're overweight, maybe because they're physically unattractive. Two things which are powerful biases against. We have a lot of lookism. So one step is I kind of know it. And knowing it, I might say, look, I'm trying my best to give them to fairly interview them and so on, but I have to be aware of the possibility that I'm going to be additionally hard on them.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, oh, they're too aggressive. They're not very personable. Their answers aren't as smart. Well, in a magical world, we could switch all those buttons. I wouldn't say the same thing.
Right.
And so I leave the interview saying, based on purely objective facts, I'm not going to hire the person, but they weren't objective at all. They just felt objective. They were percolated through my biases, implicit or explicit. So how do we fix that? And I'll try out an argument, which is knowledge of the problem is part of the thing, but simply trying hard is not going to work. You can't make bias go away by just saying, I'm not going to be biased. Take a more mild, acceptable example of bias. If I'm reading essays and judging how good they are, and one of them is by one of my sons, I'm not going to be biased. I'm going to read his fairly. And then I'm going to come up to you and say, this is the best essay. I wasn't biased at all. I tried not to be biased. I succeeded. It's just a damn best essay. And you wouldn't trust me. You would say, you failed.
Yeah.
And so I think the solution for these things, and I'm not the first to make this argument, is you don't change the person's head. You change the world in certain ways. So if I'm biased by how attractive a person is, I should make my judgments without seeing how they look. If I'm biased by their skin color, I should not know their skin color. If I'm biased by my relative or not, I shouldn't know that. So one solution is to do all these things blind to the circumstances that might bias you. Another very different thing is to have some sort of thing like quotas or requirements that kind of force an equity to counterbalance our own biases that we don't like. And they're very different solutions to do a, say, colorblind versus, say, have a rule X percent have to be of this group. And they come from very different political commitments. But they both serve the same purpose, which is how do you get rid of a bias that people can't shake just by wanting to?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right that we can't rely on just our sheer will to undo these biases. There's, as far as I know, there is no bias in all of psychology for which that works.
Yes.
It is a notoriously difficult and thorny issue, and particularly in this case, because as you say, and as Freud might take delight in us saying, we can rationalize our way through a whole lot of prejudiced behaviors. So I agree with everything you said. And in fact, if we want to see large scale changes, making changes to the structures, to the rules is, I think, the best and perhaps only way to go. I just want to add something, though. And that thing that I want to add is more about our individual moral development. There is virtue in making systemic structural changes for the sake of equity. That probably makes a way bigger difference. But if it comes to my own views and my own prejudices, sure, I can't will my way into being less prejudiced. But what I can do is expose myself and build relationships with people who are members of the groups that I might have a slightly negative or implicit bias against. And I think in my own life, that's been the one thing that has been a salve for my own racism, for my own prejudices, is to develop relationships with people and actually love those people and actually care for those people. And there I feel my prejudices kind of simmering away, kind of falling away in a bit. And I think that I become a better person. So you don't like Mexicans? Go become friends. Go to a community event. Make friends with people who are Mexican. And I think that not only will you change, maybe your change on the IT score, you will become a better person because you will have exposed yourself to and made yourself even care about and love people who you might never have done otherwise. So this is my Pollyanna-ish view of how to defeat prejudice. It might not work at a societal level, but I look at it like this. If you want to stop poverty, the best thing probably to do is to donate to one of the many charities. Work hard. If you're an attorney, you work hard, you make $500 an hour. Work harder and make more money and give it to that charity. Sure. But if you want to change yourself, volunteering to help out people in your community who are poor and actually spending some time with them, I think will make a change in your life and probably in the lives of those people that would never have come about with the more cold, rational, systemic change. How's that?
Wow. You've come out as a much kinder person than I am. I was just satisfied to make systemic social changes and then not work on myself so much. But I'm finding this inspiring. All I'll say is, besides you being an excellent role model for me, because I think those are excellent points. And there's broader debates over effective altruism and the general question of how to be a good person, where I think you're reminding us and reminding me that often sort of thinking, how can I make the world a better place? We should also be thinking, how do we make ourselves better people within this world? What I'll say is that there are many people who do exactly the opposite of what you're describing. You know, you can find anything on social media. And there's a lot of people I know who delight, and that's the word I would use, delight, in showing videos of, say, Black people committing crimes. And they watch them over and over again. And they're doing the opposite. They're purposefully hardening their hearts. And we do that when we are in a sort of confrontation with a group. You know, your country's at war. You'll watch atrocities being done by the other side. You're in a political battle. You'll watch the other side, be they Democrats, Republicans, or whatever. You'll watch their ugliest moments. And you'll try to build up your stereotypes, your biases, implicit and explicit, in ways that expand on your hatred. And I think that's a very human trait. And I think, I don't know, what you're suggesting is a very moral alternative.